Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I am John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Tuesday, March 28, 2017. Amnesty International calls on the Kiir administration to free all political detainees.
While the individual is detained, the lives of the family members and the lives of, you know, other people that know them are left at a standstill. Because if you do not know where your relative is, or if you do not know what is happening to them, and these people are not being subjected through the due process of the law.
And Sudan opens a new corridor for humanitarians trying to reach hungry South Sudanese.
It is of great concern that these people are coming to us in very poor conditions. They are leaving South Sudan in principle because they cannot afford to live there. They do not have enough food. They do not have enough security.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. Amnesty International is calling on South Sudanese authorities to release people detained without charges by security agencies, including 28 men held at South Sudan's National Security Service headquarters in Juba. President Salva Kiir recently pledged to free all political detainees, but the British-based rights group says hundreds remain locked up in appalling conditions. Tito Justin has the story for VOA from Juba.
Amnesty International South Sudan campaigner Nyagot Tut says President Kiir must order a full investigation into all abuses by security agencies, including arbitrary detentions, torture, enforced disappearances, and deaths while in custody. The rights group says some people who have been either arrested or detained have disappeared without a trace. Tut says the government should pardon those detained or try them in a court of law according to South Sudanese law.
Several of these individuals that are being held are accused of, you know, providing some sort of support or communicating with the opposition group, but nobody has been investigated and none of them has been charged.
Tut says at least 20 men have died in detention at three separate detention centers between February 2014 and December 2016 in the capital. The whereabouts of some of the detainees, including Anton Nyero, James Lual and Lawrence Bagda, remain unknown. Tut is asking the government to disclose whether these people have died and if so, where they have been buried so relatives can carry out burial rites according to their religious practices.
What is forgotten is that while the individual is detained, the lives of the family members and the lives of, you know, other people that know them are left at a standstill. Because if you do not know where your relative is, or if you do not know what is happening to them, and these people are not being subjected through the due process of the law, then, you know, it makes the situation very hard for both the detainees and, you know, and the family members. And South Sudan would ineffectively be violating its own constitution by not ensuring that these people are taken through due process.
She says if President Kiir pardons those still in detention, it will show the president is willing to fulfill the pledge he made during a recent event.
If President Kiir acts on his promise to release any other political detainees, as he announced, you know, during the National Day of Prayer, I think he will send a message of political goodwill or a message of, you know, a genuine call where, you know, where individuals that have been wrongly accused of being opposition, you know, without any evidence, are then being released or charged.
Presidential spokesman Atteni Weka Atteni denies the Kiir administration is holding any political detainees. He says, to his knowledge, there were only two political detainees, Elias Waya and Andrea Dominic, both of whom President Kiir pardoned during the National Prayer Day.
What I know so far, as president was looking for who are the political detainees to release them, there were no any single detainee in our custodies. We don't detain people on, you know, based on the political cases.
Atten says if the government finds a record of any political detainees being held by national security agents, it will free them according to the amnesty President Kiir granted to all those who have taken up arms against the government earlier on. As to the whereabouts of two South Sudanese men who Amnesty International says were arrested in Kenya and later taken to Juba, Agri Idri chairman of the SPLM-SPLA-IO Humanitarian Affairs Committee, and Dong Samuel Luak, a lawyer and human rights advocate, attorney had this to say.
Kenya and Juba are not the same thing. Kenya and South Sudan are two different countries. If anybody is detained in Kenya, they should ask Kenyan authorities, not South Sudan. Unless they believe that South Sudan can do magic thing, even to arrest South Sudanese citizens inside Kenya or in other countries. This is completely rubbish.
And attorney says people being detained by South Sudan's National Security Service may not be classified as political detainees. He says National Security Service officers detain people who have interfered with the security of the country. For VOA News, I am Tito Justin in Juba.
The Sudanese government says it's opening a new humanitarian corridor for the United Nations World Food Program this week to deliver food to hungry South Sudanese. The new route begins in Sudan's Kordofan state and crosses into the former Unity state, where an estimated 100,000 people are facing famine. Nabil Biagio reports for VOA from Khartoum.
Ahmed Mohammed Adam, who runs Sudan's Humanitarian Aid Commission, says the new route means aid workers will be able to reach hundreds of thousands of South Sudanese who have nothing to eat.
The government of Sudan has agreed to open up a new route from Al-Obeid, Heglig, Rabokona, Bentiu, so that we can deliver aid to Unity State and Greater Bahar al-Ghazal, where the people most affected by the famine in South Sudan reside.
In 2014, the government of Sudan and South Sudan signed a memorandum of understanding that allows WFP to deliver 65,000 tons of food aid from Sudan's White Nile state to South Sudan. Speaking in Arabic, Adam says, the new route by road will open immediately.
The delivery of food to these areas should start this week. To that effect, the government has donated 10,000 sacks of sorghum, which are now in our storehouses in Adibabed, ready to be transported through the newly established route.
Marta Reuters, the UN resident and humanitarian coordinator in Sudan, says over the last 3 months, the largest number of South Sudanese refugees have crossed into Sudan, fleeing hunger in their country. Reuters says most South Sudanese arriving in Sudan are extremely malnourished and exhausted.
It is of great concern that these people are coming to us in very poor conditions. They are leaving South Sudan in principle because they cannot afford to live there. They do not have enough food. They do not have enough security. It is our hope that we are able to feed these people in South Sudan so that they do not feel the need to come in such great numbers to Sudan.
Sudan is host to more than 350,000 South Sudanese refugees who fled their country since the outbreak of fighting began more than 3 years ago. Reuters says the new route will help aid workers reach people in famine-afflicted areas of South Sudan, which were not possible to reach before.
We have been discussing with the government of Sudan how to reach this difficult-to-access population, which is a large population of South Sudanese refugees in need of assistance.
WFP says it will deliver to South Sudan 11,000 metric tons of sorghum in 7 convoys of 30 to 40 trucks this week. It says this amount will be enough to feed 300,000 people for 3 months. The convoys will travel up to 4 days to complete the 500-kilometer journey from Al-Obeid to Bentiu. It's particularly important that the new humanitarian corridor is opening now before the rainy season starts, which will mean that WFP can avoid resorting to extremely expensive airdrops for starving South Sudanese. For VOA News, I'm Nabil Biagio in Khartoum.
Aid agencies in South Sudan say the killing of 6 aid workers on Saturday in a government-controlled area highlights the threat humanitarians face as they provide life-saving assistance across the country. The agencies say unless the government protects aid agencies, they will not operate in areas that are insecure. Waki Simon Wudu has more for VOA from Juba.
8 officials met today with the Cabinet Affairs Minister Martin Elia Lomuro and other officials to talk about what is going to be done in wake of the deadly weekend attack. Pio Ding, chairperson of international non-governmental organizations in South Sudan, who also works for Finnish Church Aid, says there is no question that the government must improve security across the country, especially for aid workers.
The security and the safety of our staff is first. And the revelation is from that point of view. That how better can we cooperate with authorities, with the relevant bodies?
Ding says humanitarians cannot deliver services where there is insecurity. And when aid workers cannot deliver assistance in several parts of South Sudan, hundreds of thousands of people suffer.
So it does affect us in a great way. And as we are speaking, as the humanitarian community, we are in a sorrowful and mournful state. And what we would like to see also is that when such incidents happen, there is investigations and there is justice that is served. People have to be held accountable to those who conduct and perpetrate such incidents.
Ding says the improved security needs to happen immediately, not just for the aid workers, but for people living in the communities. The UN's humanitarian coordinator in South Sudan, Eugen Owusu, says Saturday's deadly attack underscores the fact that South Sudan is one of the most dangerous countries for aid workers to operate in and makes it that much harder to confront the humanitarian challenges across the country.
We have an obligation to support the needy and to support the most vulnerable. That is why we are in this country, and we will continue to do that to the best of our abilities. When unfortunate incidents like what happened over the weekend do happen, of course, naturally, it saddens us and it dampens our energies.
Owusu says the vehicle the aid workers were traveling in on their way to Piboro from Juba was stopped by a known gunman. The aid workers were ordered to get out and then were lined up and shot to death. Owusu says the killers did not take any items from the slain aid workers and called the shootings an execution. Cabinet Affairs Minister Lomuro condemned the incident and says the government will carry out investigation to track down the killers.
And if the culprits are under government control areas or they're within our system, of course it's easy to get hold of them. But if they were robbers or gangsters that are obstructing and conducting these actions in order to sabotage government work, then we will need to do more than just investigating.
The UN says at least 88 workers have been killed in South Sudan since the outbreak of the conflict erupted in late 2013. Most of the victims have been South Sudanese nationals. For VOA News, I'm Waki Simon Wudu in Juba.
Still in Juba, some internally displaced persons living in a UN protection of civilian sites in Juba accused the head of the Joint Monitoring and Evaluation Commission of failing to do his job and are calling for his removal. They say government forces continue to kill, rape and commit other crimes against civilians with impunity. JMAC has reported on ceasefire violations and blamed both sides in the conflict for these violations. But IDPs say Mr. Mohai is not accurately telling the international community everything about the terrible conditions in South Sudan. Michael Atid has more for VOA from Juba.
Bikan Kwal, a community leader at the IDP camp in Juba, says JMAC chairman Festus Mohai, the former president of Botswana, has betrayed thousands of IDPs living in UN-run camps and South Sudanese refugees that fled to neighboring countries. Kwal accuses government forces of violating the 2015 peace agreement several times over. He says Mohai refused to speak out about repeated ceasefire violations, and IDPs like him have lost hope in the JMAC chief's ability to monitor implementation of the peace agreement.
We, the South Sudanese Anonymous Protection of Civilians, came across the camp to reject the continuation of Mr. Mugard as chairman of JMAC Monitoring and Evaluation Commission, as he has shown beyond any reasonable doubt that he is no longer impartial and was at his fear of telling the truth to the international community about the actual event happening in the country.
Kwal says many IDPs believe The peace deal was first violated when former First Vice President Riek Machar was forced out of Juba days after new fighting erupted between government forces and rebel forces loyal to Riek Machar back in July. President Salva Kiir later replaced Machar with Taban Deng Gai, who was mining minister before being tapped to be first vice president. Kwol says since July, government forces have violated the peace agreement many times, and JEMEC chairman Mohai has remained silent about the killings, rapes, and torture.
We, the IDP, we want peace, but peace without Mr. Felto Magai, because Felto Magai has failed in reporting everything because he was a chairperson of JEMEC. He's supposed to monitor the peace. He's supposed to try whatever obstruct the peace. But unfortunately, he failed to do that. His being here in Juba is nothing.
On February 8th, South Sudan in Focus reported that Mohai called the renewed fighting between government forces and the armed opposition in Wau, Kajukeji, and Upper Nile a blatant violation of the ceasefire. Mohai said he wanted all parties to respect the ceasefire and restore peace, and that the ceasefire and transitional security arrangements monitoring mechanism, or the CITISAM, would investigate the violations.
Individually and collectively, JNA condemns the violence. CITISAM has begun their investigations, and I call upon all parties involved to cease all military activity and cooperate fully with these investigations.
Mohai also said last month that the continued disrespect for the ceasefire by both sides, other armed groups, and what he called criminals over the past few months had worsened the situation, forcing many civilians to flee the country. Kwal says that is not enough. He accuses Mohai of holding on to a failed mission. Anne Dao, a 39-year-old mother of eight, says she no longer wants to live as an IDP. Dao says she and her children want peace so that they can return to their home. She wonders what kind of future her children will have if they grow up in the IDP camp, not being able to interact with other children.
We need to move freely because during last year, the time Dr. Machar was here, we was out all of us, even we tried to access our home, we tried to move freely without fear. But for the case of July 2016, there was a lot of rape, there was a lot of killing, even women were killed during that time. So now, for this time, we need Pastor Magai to be there.
27-year-old Magdiel Guy is another IDP who believes it is time for Mohai to go. Guy says he has lived in the UN camp for nearly 4 years now and had to drop out of school.
We are a lot of in PO side, like we are paralyzed and we do nothing. If I could get a chance to be outside, we could do a lot of things. Example, others use may start education and study and go ahead with their life activities. Others may even do development.
South Sudan in Focus has repeatedly reached out to JEMEC's communications officer in Juba, Muhammad Adao, for comment on this story. Adao says he forwarded our request for an interview to the highest authority at JEMEC. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Juba.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, is a somewhat effective vaccine against HIV better than no vaccine at all? Find out more when we come back.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
how far do you have to go to access clean drinking water?
I live in the city, so I don't really have to travel much. I have drinking water right in my home.
We actually have to walk about 2.5 miles for a bucket of water. I think we need more boreholes in the community.
For myself, I don't go far because I buy my water within the family from donkey, which carries water from house to house.
Basically, we don't have actually clean drinking water because even in my compound, I don't have a tap that is already coming to my compound. So normally we go to the neighborhood in a dark well. That is where we go and pull water.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
For in-depth news and analysis on events in South Sudan, tune in to South Sudan in Focus, Monday through Friday from 1630 to 1700 UTC. We are also on the web at www.voanews.com/South Sudan or download our podcast on iTunes. That's South Sudan in Focus on VOA Africa.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. It's time for our Tuesday health segment, and today we are talking about polio. Tens of thousands of health workers will fan out across 13 Central and West African countries to vaccinate more than 116 million children under the age of 5 against polio. The World Health Organization and UNICEF are spearheading the immunization campaign to rid the continent of the last vestiges of crippling disease. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The UN agencies report more than 190,000 volunteers traveling on foot or bicycle will go house to house across all cities, towns, and villages in 13 countries to vaccinate every child under age 5 against polio. The synchronized vaccination campaign, one of the largest ever conducted in Africa, will run from March 25th to 28th. Director of Polio Eradication at the World Health Organization, Michel Zafran, says children must be immunized in a short span of time to raise childhood immunity to polio across the continent.
The synchronization of these immunization campaigns is needed to rapidly strengthen protection. If all children are vaccinated at the same time, or around the same time, in a very short period of time, the virus cannot find anywhere to hide.
In August 2016, 4 children were paralyzed by polio in Borno State in northeast Nigeria, which has been under attack by Boko Haram militants for several years. It was the first time in more than 2 years that polio was detected in Africa. Governments in the Lake Chad Basin declared a public health emergency, and a vaccination campaign was conducted. Zafran says there has been no case of polio since the last one was detected on August 21st. Nevertheless, he tells VOA there is concern that the polio virus still may be circulating in this area because of the humanitarian crisis exacerbated by political instability and conflict. He says health workers are operating under very dangerous and difficult circumstances.
We cannot be sure that some of our vaccinators or health workers could not be collateral damages of a suicide bombing, which is not directly attacking the vaccination site. This has not been the target of these insurgents, but they could be actually hurt because of the proximity of the event.
The African countries will be declared polio-free if no case of polio is detected in the next 3 years. That will bring the goal of global polio eradication very near, as only 5 cases of polio remain in Afghanistan and Pakistan. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Still on health matters, researchers say even a partially effective vaccine against HIV could help turn the corner on the disease when used in combination with aggressive diagnosis and treatment. VOA's Jessica Barman has this report.
When it comes to the deployment and use of an HIV vaccine, researchers say even a partially effective vaccine, although not perfect, still could prevent millions of infections each year. There are no AIDS vaccines in use, but many are in the development pipeline or clinical trials. The problem is the vaccines are turning out to be less effective than hoped. To get a handle on what the future might hold, scientists at Oregon State University developed a mathematical model of HIV progression, transmission, and intervention tailored to 127 countries around the world. According to the model, using current interventions, the world might expect to see about 49 million new cases of HIV in the next 20 years. But the study concluded that 25 million of those infections might be prevented if ambitious targets for diagnosis, treatment, and viral suppression set by the United Nations are met. And that's where an HIV vaccine comes in. According to study lead author Jan Medlock, adding a vaccine to the mix, even one that's only 50% effective, by 2020 could prevent another 6.3 million new infections, potentially reversing the HIV pandemic.
Partial efficacy is still better than zero efficacy, and it, you know, really becomes, you know, thinking about the costs and trade-offs, you know, are you taking away money from treatment or some other health program to buy these vaccines? If not, then, you know, they're probably worth doing, even at very low efficacy.
Medlock's model, reported in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, input clinical data from a vaccine that's now in large-scale trials in South Africa. Until it was modified for the Phase 3 trial in the hopes of boosting its effectiveness, the vaccine candidate showed about a 60% efficacy in preventing infection for the first year. The effectiveness dropped to 31% 3.5 years later. Even without an improvement in current levels of HIV detection and treatment globally, a vaccine that's only 50% effective has the potential to avert 17 million new cases during the next two decades, according to Medlock. Medlock adds an even less effective vaccine could make a sizable dent to slow the pandemic.
20% efficacy at the global population scale is still going to prevent several million infections.
Medlock says many countries will inevitably fall short of the UN's ambitious goals to contain the HIV pandemic. That's why researchers believe the firepower of imperfect HIV vaccines should be brought to bear in the fight against the AIDS virus. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
That's our show for this Tuesday. We join South Sudanese football fans in Juba to celebrate the victory over Djibouti. I hear the score was 6-0. We now leave you with the song Amber by Benjamin Laxin.
Amber, yeah, Amber, yeah, yeah. Amber, yeah, yeah, patilipa.
Amber, yeah, yeah, Amber, yeah, yeah. Amba yeye patilipa.
Ngira na sodo mugu, ngira na sodo mugu, ngira na sodo mugu, beli bibilo gandara.
Amba yeye, amba yeye, amba yeye patilipa.
Ngira na kekeli, ngira na kekeli, beti kasreketi.
Amba yeye, amba yeye. Amba yeye patilipa.
Ngirona rudongo, ngirona rudongo, ngirona rudongo kubona amba.
Amba yeye, amba yeye, amba yeye patilipa.
Ngalaga kuden amba bero, ku amba longodi kiko, ngajikine mindo lenga beri. Ngirola suda beti manyan, kote ibakana, patilipa lolele kike dingi ki. Ikururunga nyo amba doti kinda ngaji kinda lenga be.
Amba yeye, amba yeye, amba yeye patilipa. Amba yeye, amba yeye, amba yeye patilipa.
Ngira na sodo mugu, ngira na sodo mugu, ngira na sodo mugu, beli bibilo gandara.
Amba yeye, amba yeye. Amba yeye patilipa.
Ngrana kekeli, ngrana kekeli, ngrana kekeli, beti kasreketi.
Amba yeye, amba yeye, amba yeye patilipa.
Ngrana rudongo, ngrana rudongo, ngrana rudongo kubona amba.
Amba yeye, amba yeye, amba yeye patilipa.
We have been listening to Benjamin Laxin with the song Amba. That song can put you in a very spotty move. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.